Well, good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for inviting me to this conference. It's a real pleasure to talk to you today. And what I'm going to be talking about today is some of scientific insights into the causes of same-sex attraction. What I hope to do is just give you a whistle-stop tour of some of the research that's been conducted in the last century and a half in this field, from the biological sciences, medical sciences, psychology, and social sciences. It's quite a lot to cover, so it'll be quite a quick run-through, but I'm very happy to answer questions in more detail at the end. And I should say that Dennis Alexander and I have a paper that's currently in press with Science and Christian Belief that's covering much the same ground I'm going to talk about today, and that'll be coming out in January. So if you're interested in the issue, I highly advise you to look for that paper when it comes out. So here's an overview of what I'm going to be talking about today. I'll be looking at three possible etiologies, which is a causal pathway of same-sex attraction: choice, environment, and biology. I'll be examining the empirical support for some of the dozens of potential causes that people have at one time or another suggested might be responsible for homosexuality. But why am I even talking about the causes of same-sex attraction to a conference on faith? Why is this important? It's important because what people think about the causes of same-sex attraction hugely affects their attitudes to social, political, and theological questions concerning the treatment of gay people in both legal and religious settings. Earlier this year, that should be a picture of a New Scientist headline where it says, "Anti-gay Uganda thinks homosexuality is a choice." Earlier this year, Uganda passed a draconian new law punishing homosexuality, which was explicitly based on an understanding that homosexuality is a choice that can be freely reversed. The Ugandan government promised that if new evidence came to light proving otherwise, they would rescind the law. So as I was saying, what people think about the causes of same-sex attraction does matter hugely to them because it affects what they think about political, social, and theological treatment of gay people. In the US, in the past few years, there has been a vigorous legal argument over whether same-sex attraction is immutable or unchangeable. That's because homosexuals cannot be granted special protection from discrimination as a suspect class under the Constitution unless their same-sex attraction is immutable or outside their control. And that debate is still legally unresolved. For a religious example, we can look at the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which states that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. What causes same-sex attraction clearly matters in a variety of different ways. And an incorrect or overly simplistic understanding of the causes of same-sex attraction may well lead to conclusions that are ungrounded, impractical, or logically invalid. Yet at the same time, this debate is not driven by a discussion of the science, but by agendas, such as a desire for legal protection. The annual Gallup Values and Beliefs poll shows how opinion in the US has changed markedly on this issue in just 30 years. In 1983, only 13% of Americans believed that sexuality was something you were born with. But in 2013, that number had risen to 47%. Is this opinion justified by the science? That's what this talk aims to discuss. So before plunging into the causes of same-sex attraction, I just want to lay some groundwork about who and what exactly we're talking about. You might have noticed that I've been quite careful so far in using the term causes of same-sex attraction rather than causes of homosexuality. And that's because attraction is just one facet of sexual orientation, along with several other related but distinct concepts, such as sexual behaviour and self-identity. These facets may not always overlap, and it's important not to conflate them. A same-sex attracted person may not engage in same-sex sexual behaviour or define themselves as homosexual. Conversely, a person with no same-sex attraction may indeed engage in same-sex sexual behaviour due to social pressure or limited opportunity. We need to be careful about extrapolating theories about sexual attraction from work that didn't measure it directly. You're probably all familiar with the 10% statistic, the claim that around 10% of the population in Western countries is gay. However, measuring same-sex attraction accurately is a lot more complicated than simply asking, are you gay or straight? Or even asking, are you attracted to people of the same sex or not? Sexual attraction is not dichotomous, but exists on a continuum. This was first recognised by Alfred Kinsey, who devised the Kinsey scale, a system for measuring different degrees of sexual attraction, from exclusively opposite sex, at number 0, to exclusively same-sex, at number 6. Kinsey scales are the best instrument we currently have to capture the complexity of people's sexual lives, though many researchers use a reduced 3-point or 5-point scale to make their statistics easier. And there are additional complications too. Which number you assign yourself to on a Kinsey scale depends not just on your true sexual attractions, but on how the original question was phrased, how many different options are offered you, and the degree of anonymity guaranteed. After all, poorly anonymized surveys in countries with restrictive laws against homosexuality are always going to return lower figures for same-sex attraction. And a particularly critical issue is the time period assessed. Most studies ask about either lifetime occurrence of same-sex attraction or just a recent period, such as the last year. But sexual attraction is a dynamic trait in a sizable minority of people. Around 10% of individuals will change their sexual attraction at some point in their life. And this change can be in any direction, from opposite sex to same sex, and vice versa, from exclusive to non-exclusive and back again. Most same-sex attracted people first felt that they were other than straight at puberty, but there are a substantial number for whom that realisation happens later in life. Therefore, the time period you ask about in your survey can make a big difference to your numbers. All these complicating factors mean that there is no one figure for how many people are same-sex attracted. Different surveys will produce different numbers, sometimes dramatically different numbers. Three surveys were taken in the US, Australia, and Norway, where the legal and social attitudes to homosexuality are broadly similar. But in the US survey, 11% of respondents said they were same-sex attracted. In Norway, it was only 1.8%. That's a difference of 10%, quite a big one. So which number do you pick? Which is correct? The answer is neither. You can't just pick a number. The best you can do is provide a qualified average. This table shows the average UK numbers for the degree of attraction and exclusive same-sex attraction and behaviour, collated from a number of different surveys carried out in the UK over the past 15 years. But if we can't provide absolute numbers, what we can do is identify trends. Consistently across all surveys, experiencing any degree of same-sex attraction is more prevalent than being exclusively same-sex attracted. That's perhaps unsurprising. Being same-sex attracted is also more common than engaging in same-sex behaviour or having a homosexual identity. It's again pretty unsurprising. More interestingly, women report a higher rate of any degree of same-sex attraction than men, but a lower amount of same-sex behaviour. Women are much more likely to define themselves as a little bit same-sex attracted, numbers 1 through 3 on the Kinsey scale, while men tend to be either exclusively opposite sex or exclusively same-sex. And this immediately suggests that the etiology of sexual attraction in men and women may be different, which is the theme we'll be pursuing throughout the talk. If you're interested in this issue, there's a great paper from 2009 by Savin Williams, which goes into these issues of complexity and definitions. Okay, so let's talk causes now. I'd like to start with a discussion of a causal pathway that is often either forgotten or dismissed by scientists, particularly by biologists, which is that of personal choice. This hypothesis suggests that sexual attraction is an act of conscious will, and that a person who is same-sex attracted can easily choose to be attracted to the opposite sex instead. This causal pathway has been suggested by a variety of different groups over the years, often for very different reasons. For instance, during the 1980s, some radical feminists argued that women should choose to become lesbians as a rejection of patriarchal oppression. In the US, it's very common to hear that homosexuality is a lifestyle choice, or that all gay people choose to be gay. Results from a Gallup poll dating back to 1983 and carried out every 2 years show that between 30 and 40% of Americans consistently have stated that homosexuality is just the way that some people prefer to live. Although I should point out that the data from that poll ended in 2006, and it's possible that attitudes have shifted a lot in the last 8 years due to the strong media focus on gay rights in that period. The question of same-sex attraction has often stirred intense media debates, reflected in stories like the one published in April 2012 by Matthew Paris in The Times, who argued that for at least some same-sex attracted people, their attraction is a conscious choice. Paris isn't alone within the gay community in thinking that. There exists a small but vocal subculture within the gay community known as queer by choice, who argue for acceptance of the idea that some same-sex attracted people have chosen to be that way for reasons of personal politics, socio-cultural factors, or a form of revolt against cultural norms. Unfortunately, there exists almost no empirical data that directly addresses this hypothesis because it's inherently unamenable to being tested. Rather surprisingly, no systematic survey has been done asking same-sex attracted people whether they believe they made a conscious choice to be that way. However, what little data we do have from anecdotal evidence and some informal surveys suggests that only a very small minority of homosexuals feel that they made a choice, with the vast majority saying that their attraction just happened or that they feel that they were born that way. As I mentioned earlier, most same-sex attracted individuals first feel that way during their early teenage years. And to suggest that all of these teenagers are making a choice which they may have seen derided in society and by the popular press seems unreasonable, at least. Whether it's even possible to choose a sexual attraction is a point that's still debated by theorists. Many sexual psychologists would argue that an experience of sexual attraction by definition cannot be consciously willed or chosen, as attraction is a fundamental mental state that is not controlled by the conscious mind. As usual, a philosopher says it best. It is important, I think, not to deny the voices of homosexual individuals who do feel that they have made a choice, but it's going contrary to a good deal of other evidence to suggest that most or all same-sex attracted people have made such a choice, if it's even possible. And there are several other plausible causes of same-sex attraction, which I'd like to move on to now. Okay, so let's move on to the real nitty-gritty, environmental and biological causes of same-sex attraction. We'll start with environmental causes. I'm defining environment here as any influence external to the person which acts to affect the sexual development of that person. Under an environmental model, same-sex attraction is not inherent to an individual, but is acquired at some stage during their development. There have been a range of suggested environmental causes over the years, including drugs, smoking, alcohol, war, and demonic action. But I'm going to focus on the three with the most empirical support: parenting, sexual abuse, and socialization. So the idea that parents can cause homosexuality in their children dates back to 1940, when it was first developed by the neo-Freudian psychoanalyst Sandor Rado. Rado attacked the established notion of the time that same-sex attraction was a developmental phase in normal sexual development, and instead postulated that male, note, only male, not female, same-sex attraction, resulted from abnormal and damaging parent-son relationships. Rado and his followers argued that the classic male homosexual was formed from what he called the triangular system. The son was theorized to have a poor relationship with the father, who was emotionally distant from his son and hostile to his emotional needs. This in turn led to the mother smothering her son to make up for the demerits of the father. Rado hypothesized that such smothering would lead to the son developing a phobia of close emotional intimacy with women and a desire for male affection. Rado's model of homosexual development was entirely theoretical when he first proposed it in 1940, but during the 1950s and early 1960s, a number of empirical studies reported finding the triangular system in studies of same-sex attracted males. The most famous of these was conducted by Irving Bieber and colleagues in New York and published in 1962. Bieber's results were deemed so convincing that the model became psychoanalytic orthodoxy. It was included in the first and second editions of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the Handbook of Psychiatry. However, critics at the time pointed out that Bieber's study and others like it were riddled with methodological flaws, small sample sizes, usually under 50, and doubtful interpretations. The homosexuals studied in the 1950s and 60s were almost always either in hospital with mental illness or in prison for homosexual offences. Sexologists such as Alfred Kinsey had already established that homosexuality was much more widespread in society than had been thought, and that many same-sex attracted people were in every other way well-adjusted and functioning members of society. In 1957, Evelyn Hooker conducted a pioneering study with a group of non-criminalised, non-institutionalised homosexuals in California. She subjected 30 same-sex attracted men to three sets of psychological tests, then asked two distinguished psychiatrists to try and distinguish between these results and test results from control opposite-sex attracted men. And psychiatrists did no better than chance. Attempts to replicate the Bieber et al. Study in the late 1960s and early 1970s with larger and more representative samples found no correlation between the quality of parent-child relationship and the chance of developing same-sex attraction, although there was quite a large correlation between poor parenting and the chance of ending up with a mental illness. The case for the triangular system collapsed, And in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association removed homosexuality from the DSM and retracted their argument that same-sex attraction was a psychiatric condition caused by poor parenting. And that remains the situation today, with no evidence that parents can cause homosexuality by the way they treat their children. A more recent environmental hypothesis, which has gained significant cultural currency, is the idea that same-sex attraction is a traumatic response developed in response to an experience of childhood sexual abuse. Cross-sectional data, mainly gathered in the US in the past decade, has found that same-sex attracted individuals retrospectively report experiencing significantly higher levels of sexual abuse as children, sometimes as much as 2 or 3-fold higher. Theorists have suggested that abuse by a person of the same sex could be interpreted as confirmation that a child is gay, or perhaps it could act as a stigma that encourages further stigmatised behaviour. If the abuse was by somebody of the opposite sex, that could perhaps provoke an avoidance of everyone of that sex. Unfortunately, these arguments are entirely theoretical. Cross-sectional data doesn't allow you to distinguish the temporal order of events, so we don't know if abuse causes same-sex attraction through one of these mechanisms. It's perfectly possible that same-sex attracted people are more vulnerable to abuse, perhaps because they appear to be or behave in a manner that is atypical. Or there could be a third underlying factor that we haven't discovered yet. A lot more work is needed in this area before we can come to any firm conclusions. However, one thing is clear. If sexual abuse in childhood is a causal factor leading to the development of same-sex attraction, it is not a necessary or sufficient explanation for all same-sex attraction, as the majority of same-sex attracted individuals do not report experiencing any form of abuse. Other etiologies are therefore necessary if we are to have a full understanding of sexual attraction and its development. And if you're interested in this field, the Anderson and Bloschnitz paper in the top there is a particularly good summary. So what about socialisation as a hypothesis? Socialisation refers to the idea that prepubertal children are blank slates when it comes to sexual attraction, and that attraction could develop as easily towards either sex, depending on socio-cultural cues and interactions. These cues could come from parents, siblings, peers, mentors, role models, or the wider culture and media. Under this model, sexual attraction must be subconsciously learned during a period of sexual development, like puberty, with the implication being that same-sex attraction occurs only when it has been taught to a child through example, imitation, or direction. The socialisation model is the hypothesis that underlies laws such as Section 28 here in the UK, or the more recent Russian law banning gay propaganda. These laws don't really make a lot of sense without this explanatory mechanism. As with personal choice, there is still a theoretical debate about whether sexual attraction can ever be learned in this way. And again, there is very little empirical work that sheds light on the issue. It's tricky to design a robust study that will hold all other factors constant while allowing you to look at the social factor of interest. A single study of male homosexuals with gay brothers, conducted in the year 2000, found that 83% of the boys had experienced some feeling of same-sex attraction before they were aware of their brother's orientation, suggesting that in males, at least, sexual attraction is not acquired from siblings. And this conclusion was supported by a study released earlier this year. The recent study took advantage of a long-running survey in California schools, where participants are asked to name their siblings and their 3 closest friends, who also complete the survey. This allows you to construct networks of friendship groups and ask if the probability of experiencing same-sex attraction passes through those networks. In other words, whether having a homosexual friend makes you more likely to be homosexual yourself. The answer is a resounding no. Neither peer influences nor sibling influences had any effect on same-sex attraction, although they had a big effect on sexual behaviour. There have also been attempts to study whether the children of same-sex attracted parents can learn by example from watching their parents and are more likely to be same-sex attracted than the children of heterosexual couples. Paul Cameron, for instance, has claimed that 30% of children of lesbian-gay couples are homosexual, a conclusion supported by absolutely no good data at all and a good deal of hidden agenda. Most studies in this area have been qualitative and narrative rather than quantitative and statistically robust. But the current consensus is that children of lesbian-gay parents are not more likely to be same-sex attracted themselves, Although on this issue, I would advise reserving judgment for a while. There are big demographic shifts currently underway in lesbian gay parenting. In some US cities now, over half of gay couples are parents. Good quality research carried out with this emerging cohort will be much more informative than speculating from our current position. But the work with siblings and peers encourages, I think, a fairly strong scepticism when considering socialisation as a cause of same-sex attraction. Right, so that's two down. On to our third category of causes, biology. As with environmental factors, I'm going to review a few different potential biological causes: genes, hormones, neurology, and birth order. So first up, let's tackle the idea of the gay gene. The gay gene has become a ubiquitous cultural phenomenon in modern society. It appears in much online discourse about same-sex attraction and is frequently cited by survey respondents when asked about the causes of same-sex attraction. The meme has appeared on posters and t-shirts, in popular books and comic strips. Responses to the idea of the gay gene have been both serious and mocking, showing that although it is a common meme, its meaning is still debated. The potential social consequences of a gay gene are contentious as well, resulting in sci-fi books like these, which have both been published in the last 6 years. The source for most of the gay gene discourse of the past 20 years is this paper, published in 1993 in Science by Dean Hamer and colleagues, who at the time were working at the National Cancer Institute in Maryland. What they did in this paper was to take 40 pairs of brothers, where both of the brothers self-identified as homosexual, and then to look at the DNA sequence in 22 locations along the X chromosome. Hamer theorized that when the brothers had the same sequence or marker at a particular location, then that was good evidence that the gene at that location was potentially contributing to their shared homosexuality. And the study did indeed find that five markers in a region of the X chromosome called XQ28 were commonly shared in both brothers. However, and it's a big however, XQ28 is not a gene. It's a spatial signifier indicating a region that is actually millions of base pairs long. There are over 400 genes within the XQ28 region, any one of which, or more than one, could be the gene of interest. It's completely false to say that this paper discovered the gay gene. So it was particularly egregious that a year later, Hamer published a book which was subtitled The Search for the Gay Gene and the Biology of Behaviour. It really isn't. And indeed, it never could have been. We can be pretty certain that there is no such thing as a single gay gene. As I mentioned earlier, sexuality is complicated and multifaceted, not dichotomous. It isn't a simple binary distinction, which can be controlled by a gene of two variant types. If sexual attraction were under the control of a single gene, we would expect to see it passed down in families like eye colour or cystic fibrosis, with a recognisable pattern of inheritance, which we absolutely don't. We would also expect identical twins to always match each other, either both gay or both straight. But in reality, they match less than 50% of the time. Since the initial paper was published in 1993, there have been two independent attempts at replicating Hamer et al.'s results using his methodology, both of which have failed to produce the same result. It seems likely that the original result was an artifact produced by bias in the small sample that was used in the Hamer study. There have also been six other attempts to detect an association between same-sex attraction and various other specific genes or regions within the human genome, none of which have produced anything significant. Nothing has been reliably replicated, and no results are highly significant. So at this stage, it's entirely false to say that any particular gene is known to contribute causally to same-sex attraction. However, that is not to say that there is no genetic influence on same-sex attraction. There might, in fact, be a significant causal influence involving hundreds or even thousands of genes. We can calculate the amount of genetic influence on same-sex attraction by using a methodology known as a twin study. Twin studies facilitate the separation of genetic and non-genetic factors potentially contributing to a trait by comparing sets of twins. Basically, the way it works is to compare sets of identical twins, who have all of their genome sequence in common, as they come from a single fertilized egg, with sets of fraternal twins, who share on average only half of their genetic information. The numbers at the bottom of the screen here are the concordance rates for same-sex attraction in identical and fraternal twins. Concordance is just whether the twins match or not. If they're both same-sex attracted, they're concordant. If only one twin is, then they're discordant. As you can see, identical twins are more likely to be concordant than our fraternal twins, which suggests that there is a genetic component acting on the trait. If we run these numbers through a series of simultaneous equations, which I'm happy to explain to anyone at the end if they're interested, not that anyone ever has been before, then we can quantify just how big that genetic influence is. The value we get is called the heritability value, and it's usually expressed as a percentage. There are a couple of important points to note about twin studies. Firstly, they do not tell you about individual genes. Knowing that there is a genetic component influencing a trait doesn't tell me which genes are involved, nor does it tell you which causal pathways might be important or how they work. And secondly, the heritability value is a population statistic. It doesn't apply on an individual level. If I say that same-sex attraction is 20% heritable, and that I don't mean that an individual person can attribute 20% of their attraction to their genes and 80% to their upbringing, say. Rather, I mean that 20% of the variance in sexual attraction within a population is influenced by the different genes that are also present within that population. As I say, I'm very happy to go over this in more detail in the Q&A, as it is quite technical. So what do twin studies tell us about sexual attraction? The first twin study was completed in 1991, and there have been a small number, around 7, done since then. I've listed some of the key examples here. Two influential early studies by J. Michael Bailey and Richard Pillard reported heritability values, genetic influence, are between 30 and 75% in male and female samples, and those figures were reported as 50% in much of the subsequent media coverage. And you may have heard this statistic of 50% genetic influence before. However, those studies were almost certainly biased by the fact that Bailey and Pillard recruited their twins via gay-friendly publications, and so they almost certainly had twin pairs who already knew that they were concordant. Subsequent twin studies have recruited from the large population-based registries that now exist in many countries. Australia, Finland, Sweden, the UK, and the US have all contributed to these studies. Overall, twin studies conclude that there is a significant genetic influence on sexual attraction. Every study returns a positive, significant result. However, there are substantial differences in the actual values reported between the different studies and no consistency. In both men and women, the heritability value ranges anywhere between 10 and 50%, which is a big difference. While some studies report high heritabilities for men and low for women, in other studies, it's completely the reverse. The most recent studies, which have the largest sample sizes and updated statistical methods, do seem to be sort of settling on a figure for men of around 30 to 40% heritable, although the jury is still out on women. It's possible that genetic influences are more causally significant in men than in women, but this remains very speculative at this point. You'll have noted as well that even if it turns out that same-sex attraction is 40% heritable in men, that leaves 60% unaccounted for. 60% of the variability in sexual attraction is associated not with genes, but with other factors. So whichever way you look at it, genes are in no way a sufficient explanation as the cause of same-sex attraction. It's quite common to hear as an argument against there being any genetic influence on same-sex attraction the fact that homosexuals have fewer children, and if you don't have children, you can't pass your gay genes onto them. There are various ways to get around this seeming paradox of evolution, but in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over that and move straight on to sex and gender atypicality. This is the theory that same-sex attracted people are the wrong sex or gender. In other words, males are feminized and females are masculinized. And this is sometimes called the intersex theory of sexual attraction. It's probably the oldest scientific hypothesis on the causes of same-sex attraction. It was first proposed in the 1850s by Carl Ulrichs, who is often regarded as the father of the scientific study of homosexuality. Ulrichs proposed that male homosexuals contained a female essence, although he left the nature of the essence undefined. The idea was picked up by the first sexologists writing at the turn of the 20th century, such as Havelock Ellis and Magnus Hirschfeld, and it only really fell out of fashion as Freud's theories of abnormal psychosexual development took over. The intersex hypothesis has been investigated in adults, children, and at the fetal stage using measures of both physical and behavioural atypicality. These studies have provided varying degrees of support for the theory that same-sex attraction is caused by a perversion of the normal sexual developmental process. Let's start with physical differences. Despite the existence of popular stereotypes about the physical build and mannerisms of same-sex attracted people, there is in fact very little evidence that the vast majority are in any way different in their physical development. Same-sex attracted people are not hermaphrodites, and you'd be amazed how often I have seen that written down. Same-sex attracted men do not have more feminized genitalia. Studies of height and weight in homosexuals have been equivocal. Homosexual people, in fact, cover the whole spectrum of builds and body types. So physicality doesn't really seem to support the intersex hypothesis. What about behavioural differences? Now here, on the face of it, you find much stronger support for the theory. There have been a fairly large number of studies in a variety of countries and cultures which have consistently found that adult same-sex attracted people engage in more gender atypical behaviour than do opposite sex attracted people. And they rate themselves as being more gender atypical. This is also true in childhood, with many children who will later go on to develop a homosexual orientation displaying gender atypical behaviours, both pre- and post-puberty. This is in fact one of the strongest findings in the field of homosexuality studies, with hardly any contradictory findings. But, once again, it's wise to be cautious in interpreting these data. Although there is a significant relationship between gender atypicality and sexual attraction, it's often only weakly significant. And many of these studies, particularly in children, have used clinical populations who are undergoing treatment for gender dysphoria, which means the findings aren't generalizable to the wider population. What's more, gender presentation is often bound up with cultural norms and practices, and people are often adept at hiding their true preferences in order to gain societal acceptance from either straight or gay society. There is a community in Samoa known as Fa'afafine. These are homosexual men who adopt feminine clothing. They are tolerated as long as they do not follow masculine norms and customs. Similarly, Iran has the highest rate of gender reassignment surgery in the world. This is because the punishment for homosexuality is so severe that males experiencing same-sex attraction often undergo gender reassignment. The connection between gender atypicality and same-sex attraction in these cultures, therefore, has everything to do with social pressure and much less to do with a direct underlying biological causal factor that might be supposed at first glance. So what might this underlying biological causal factor be? Investigations are focused on two areas: hormonal exposure in utero and adult neurological structure. Sexual development in humans is driven by hormones known as androgens, which include testosterone, dihydrotestosterone, and androestradione. High levels of androgens cause masculinization of the sex organs and secondary sexual characteristics. An androgen concentration is ultimately controlled by the SRY gene on the Y chromosome. Dozens of studies have attempted to show that same-sex attraction is correlated with abnormal levels of androgens, too high in women and too low in men. But unfortunately, this is quite difficult to prove. You can't directly sample fetal blood concentrations of androgens because the procedure is too high risk and invasive. So investigators have used proxies to indirectly measure hormone concentration in the fetus, such as measuring the amniotic fluid or measuring the ratio between the second and fourth fingers. One study carried out with the BBC in 2007 measured finger ratios from over 240,000 people. But results from this sort of study have been very inconsistent, often giving completely contradictory results to the study that came before it. Probably the best evidence for the role of hormones in same-sex attraction comes from what's called natural experiment populations. These are groups with rare genetic mutations that affect their hormone concentration. Women with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, have elevated androgen concentration due to a mutation in their cortisol pathway. Around 10 studies have found that the rate of same-sex fantasy and same-sex attraction among CAH sufferers is higher than in the general population, anywhere between 15 and 40%, compared to a base rate of 8 to 10%. CAH women are also much more likely to be exclusively same-sex attracted, which is very rare in women. Now, this finding is fairly reliable, but there are difficulties of interpretation. Women with CAH tend to look unfeminine, being shorter and heavier on average. And they often find heterosexual sex painful due to the effects of corrective genital surgery that is given to CAH women at birth to remove masculine genital tissues. This could prompt feelings of greater masculinity in these women, as could social expectations that CAH women are butch. Thus, CAH women may not view their own feelings as being strictly same-sex. Interpretation is even more difficult with the inverse population, which is men who cannot detect circulating androgens due to a mutation in their androgen receptor gene. Even though these individuals are XY, the lack of androgens means that they develop as women, which is the default sex in humans. They have feminized genitalia and are physically and socially entirely female. Labeling these individuals as men and categorizing their relationships with men as same-sex relationships when they do not view it that way themselves is highly problematic. So overall, the evidence that for hormonal effects on same-sex attraction is so limited by difficulties of measurement that it's extremely hard to draw fair conclusions about hormones and their causal effects. What about neurology? Human brains are sexually dimorphic in size, structure, and disease susceptibility. Perhaps same-sex attraction is caused by having a too masculine or too feminine brain. You're probably all aware of one of the most famous, or rather infamous, studies in the field of homosexuality studies, which is the 1991 study of Simon LeVay, who was reported to have found the gay brain. LeVay performed post-mortem tissue dissection on the brains of 41 mid-aged adults and measured a part of the hypothalamus known as the third interstitial nucleus, or inner three. LeVay reported that the brains of homosexual males had significantly smaller inner three volume than those in heterosexual males. The smaller size meant that the homosexual male brain looked more like a female brain. LeVay's study generated a huge amount of publicity, but it's not widely remembered now that it was actually the middle paper of three that came out in consecutive years from 1990 to 1992. The other two papers also reported finding differences in brain structure between hetero and homosexuals, in the anterior commissure and in another part of the hypothalamus. The combined power of these three papers meant that for a while, it was accepted orthodoxy that the gay brain was a recognisable phenomenon. However, these results have not stood up over time, and attempts to replicate the results have failed. One reason might be the fact that the original studies never verified same-sex attraction directly with the probands. It was merely assumed from the fact that the patient had died of AIDS. There was also not enough attempt to control for the possible effects of having HIV and the drug regimes that were taken to cope with the disease. More recently, with the advent of magnetic resonance imaging and other complex brain scanning techniques, further attempts have been made to map physical or functional differences in the brains of hetero and homosexual individuals. And I'll skip that, because you can't see the scans. Now, these results seem pretty conclusive, but because MRI scanning is hugely expensive, not a single recent brain scanning study has been replicated, and they all have very small sample sizes. No consistent and reliable differences have been shown to distinguish the brains of same-sex attracted and opposite-sex attracted individuals. Until there is such replication, it is impossible to make firm claims about the effect of neural structure and function on sexual attraction. And besides, there is a more fundamental problem than that. We're looking for the causes of same-sex attraction here, but the brain is plastic, not fixed. It's not unreasonable to suggest that the experience of feeling same-sex attraction, practicing same-sex behaviour, and associating with different groups of peers will have a neurological impact. You can't say for sure that any neurological differences between straight and gay people are causal. They might be the exact opposite. So lastly, let's look at a hypothesis that frequently gets a mention from the lay public, what's known as the fraternal birth order effect. Since as far back as the 1930s, it's been speculated that same-sex attraction in males might be somehow related to sibling number or to birth order, as it was observed that many same-sex attracted men came from large families. This was not seriously investigated, however, until the mid-1990s, when a Canadian research group began to look into birth order. Their research has consistently and reliably found that younger brothers in a family of boys are significantly more likely to be same-sex attracted than their older brothers, independent of socioeconomic status, maternal age, and overall family size. It's also independent of the number of sisters a boy has, Only older brothers produce the effect, hence the name fraternal birth order. These results have also been replicated by independent groups, making it one of the most reliable findings in the whole field. What's also noticeable is the size of the effect that is reported. In some samples, a boy was a third more likely to be same-sex attracted for each older brother that he had. In the original 1996 paper from the Canadian group, an almost ridiculous 70% of fourth or younger brothers were homosexual. At the moment, we simply don't know what causes this effect. The current best theory is that it's an immune response. The phenotype is increasingly severe with each male pregnancy, and it's suggested that the male fetus produces what's called a Y-linked antigen, which is a small chemical compound of the immune system that's only produced by the Y chromosome. The antigen passes through the placental barrier into the maternal bloodstream and raises an immune response, because of course the mother has no Y chromosome, so she views it as alien. The mother's immune system produces an antibody, which passes back through the placental barrier and into the fetus, and somehow affects sexual development. Support for this idea has come from the fact that older sisters don't affect their brother's chances of being same-sex attracted, because of course they aren't producing the antigen. Adopted brothers don't have an effect either. A boy that is adopted into a family with many older but non-related brothers does not have an increased likelihood of same-sex attraction. And that strongly suggests that the effect is prenatal. However, and you knew there was a however coming, it's never been directly shown that male fetuses can provoke such an immune response in their mother. And secondly, the putative mode of action of the maternal antibody is a black box. How does the antibody work? Does it cause mutations in the genetic code, alter the fetal epigenome, affect hormone concentrations, change something about brain development? We simply don't know. All we've done, really, is move the problem of causation up a level. We haven't really addressed the root of the problem. I should also emphasise that, although the fraternal birth order effect appears to be a genuine effect and a significant cause of same-sex attraction, again, it is neither necessary nor sufficient. There are many firstborn sons who are same-sex attracted, and many, many younger sons who are opposite-sex attracted. Attempts at estimating how many gay men might be gay due to this effect range between around 15 and 30%, which is non-negligible for sure, but it still leaves 70% of the homosexual population unaccounted for. Much more work is needed on the maternal immune hypothesis before we can draw any strong conclusions about its effect. So that was rather a breakneck rush through some of the different hypotheses that have been advanced as causes of same-sex attraction. What are the general conclusions we can draw from all this? Well, firstly, as you've hopefully picked up, much of the field is plagued by a lack of replication and inconsistency. Although some causal models have received more empirical support than others, no cause has yet gained sufficient support to provide a truly compelling explanation, although we can be fairly sure that there are distinct etiological pathways in men and women. In men, genetic influences on same-sex attraction cannot be ruled out, although any genetic variants that do influence same-sex attraction will be of small effect, and there is no single gay gene. The fraternal birth order effect is also well supported, but there is no firm evidence for an immunological explanation for this observation. In women, almost the only positive evidence comes from hormonal studies suggesting that exposure to elevated androgen can lead to developmental changes causing an attraction to women. But these data need to be treated with caution. Certain causal pathways, such as those resulting from childhood sexual abuse, may be significant for a small percentage of the homosexual population, but they require more research. By contrast, there is no positive evidence that same-sex attraction is caused by socialization, by personal choice, or by poor parenting. Our principal conclusion, though, is that no one causal mechanism is both necessary and sufficient to explain the whole gamut of human sexual attraction. And this is not really a very surprising conclusion when you think about it. Sexual attraction is a highly complex trait where multiple pathways can produce the same end result. It seems likely that across the variety of human personalities and cultures, different influences are important at different times and in different people. Not all homosexual men will be carrying the same variant genes. Not all homosexual women are masculinized. It's perfectly possible that one same-sex attracted woman might owe her attraction principally to hormones, while in another the primary influence is genetic. The social and cultural environment in which people live creates a complex system in which biological makeup is integrated with multiple broader factors. So therefore, there is no point in looking for the cause of same-sex attraction. Simply doesn't exist. And this negative conclusion is quite important, because both Christians and others sometimes assume that the etiology of same-sex attraction is known and straightforward. But it is not. So with that, I'll just acknowledge my supervisor at the Faraday Institute, Dr. Dennis Alexander, and I'll open it up for questions.